Good evening, James McCann here with my Science Hour, November 24th, 2016, and this is Thanksgiving. Whoa, what a year this has been. What an insane year. But what do we have to be thankful for? And I know a lot of people eat their Thanksgiving dinner. Some listen to this show while they're eating, or some eat early and then sit down, the whole family, and listen to this show. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And the wonderful listeners out there, you are the people that make this show what it is. A lot of listeners all over the world. Yesterday morning, I was on the John Moore show, and a caller called in and asked, what should he do to prepare? Is there imminent crash of economies, etc.? And what I said is, you always live two lives. One is the simple life, where you have everything you need in a remote place, all of your food, you can your clean water, shelter, everything you need, you know, multiple sets of clothes to last for a long time, you know, extra hand tools, and go out there and live and enjoy that primitive lifestyle. But also understand that what you should be doing is developing a business. In the world of education, some people can go get an education, get a good job, but that's what I tell kids. In fact, I've been in education. I spent 10 years of my life teaching university-level mathematics, physics, computer science, astronomy. And what I tell students is, don't get an education to get a job, because that creates a glass ceiling for you. It creates a limit on what you're going to make. I don't care what profession you go into, but there's a limit. And the people that make real money don't have limits. So create a business. Create a business. We're living in a world of worldwide internet economy, where you can sell products all over the world. The old brick and mortar style stores, the ones that are functioning well today, also have an internet base, and they probably do 10 times better with their internet base than they do with their brick and mortar store. There's an example of a guy selling shoes, and they were, you know, had their customers, small town, people came in, bought their shoes, and then they went on the internet. They did some internet marketing, and all of a sudden they grew to huge volumes. To 10 or 100 times what they had done or could have done in their brick-and-mortar store. But they kept the brick-and-mortar store, but that was their basis. But anyway, in the world of today, here's what I recommend that people do. Find something that you love to do. The United States is completely devoid of manufacturing, so start a manufacturing business. Once you start manufacturing one thing, you will be able to manufacture other things that are similar, and you can grow. You have to keep your focus. Don't get out of line, and don't try and do too many things and try and grow too fast. But there's a huge demand for manufacturing in the United States. So all of these people that left are going to be clamoring to come back. But you know what? It's going to be very difficult for them to move all that equipment back to the United States and start up and hire the help, etc. The person that really has an advantage is the guy that's already here. Start, have a small shop. And I've been in various businesses. Right now, I have quite a few businesses. I have water tanks. I have my water filter line, which is now 15 years and running, doing, you know, not the best in the world, but it's doing quite well. And so it's for, you know, you do what you can do. And then, of course, my books and things like that. Those are things that I love. I want to be in the water filter business. I believe that water storage is important. So those are the things I've chosen to do. There's other things that I've bypassed and said, no, I don't want to do that. There's I have a health product via Viente, but it's a very simple product. It's one product. It's not a massive product line. But other people might want to do that or sell the products that other people make. My point is that I see a very bright economic future in spite of the negativity, etc. there's going to be a lot of investment coming into the United States, and that investment needs some place to put it in manufacturing, in people's ability to do things. And if you're in the right position where you can manufacture with metals, with plastics, with materials, cloth, leather, wood, whatever, that's what I say. Find something you love to do and create. And this is to young and old alike and everybody in between. If you're already retired, then that's great. You're going to enjoy the golf games, etc. But I'll tell you, in the terms of standard economics, I should have retired a long time ago if I were just working, say, what you'd call a normal job. But I love my science work. I love doing this radio show. I love doing the paid casts on a weekly basis, putting those up there, in spite of the fact that I get hacked and my radio show interviews get cut off when I'm on there. That tells me I'm doing something right. But I'm very thankful for everything that's happened, and I'm looking forward to a very bright future. Take a positive attitude and live that dual lifestyle where you have everything you need. People talk about buying emergency equipment. I always tell them, do not hide it in the closet someplace. Take it out and use it. All of your emergency equipment, you should be very familiar with it. If an emergency happens, and I'm not talking necessarily about Planet X coming through the solar system, I'm talking about floods, I'm talking about earthquakes. Look at how many people are in an earthquake zone now that never would have dreamt of that 10 years ago. So all of these different, just bad weather. It can happen any place. Heavy rain, high winds, all of a sudden, there you are. You got to take care of yourself. So be prepared. Get your the prepper equipment and learn how to use it. Learn how to take care of yourself and your family. And don't be preoccupied about the future. Be very happy. Be very positive. The people that I find are the happiest are the people that can take care of themselves. The people that are unhappy are the people that they're just worried about the government's going to give them something next week or whatever. I also mentioned this on John Moore's show. I said, people got to stop looking to the government for, take care of me, or I got this problem, or I got that problem. The people that are the happiest are the people that take care of themselves. Okay, so anyway, what am I thankful for? Health, bright future, positive attitude, and looking forward to many, many good years and a lot of hard work yet to come. I've got a lot of projects that I'm working on in the background, and this past year has been a tough year for mostly everybody, and I would say the past couple of decades. But anyway, I'm thankful, very thankful, because I think we have a bright future, and that makes me tick. That makes me want to work more. Just a quick comment here. Late postings on my page recently. I apologize for that. I've been rebuilding my computer systems after some major crashes that occurred thanks to some of our friends out there. And it just seems like, this is something that happens like on an annual basis. I've just learned to come to live with it. So anyway, I think things are pretty much back to normal now. And a lot of my processes are much more efficient. It took a while to get up to this point. Remember to listen to last week's show. I had an interview. I rarely have interviews on my show, but this woman does very wonderful work, Sylvia Ivanova. And so listen to last week's show. Last week's paid cast is a very important paid cast. Tesla's Mind in the ongoing series, The Wardenclyffe Tower. So make sure you listen to that also. And this week's paid cast show, by the way, deals with various topics of water pollution around the United States and around the world. And so I delve into specific areas of very high concern, let's just put it that way. I want to talk today about earthquakes in Japan, New Zealand, a major, there's a hurricane coming into Costa Rica right now. And that's somewhat, they say, an unusual storm, has not happened for over 100 years. And there's some other Caribbean islands related. So very unusual storm, but there's nothing to prevent storms from occurring in these areas. We're almost at the end of the hurricane season, but there again, we've had hurricanes in January, February. The hurricanes are not driven by warm water, and so they're driven by solar conditions, solar electric conditions that filter down through our atmosphere to the troposphere where the weather systems are working. And so at any rate, let me start out with this article. However, I have a picture on my webpage. On the very top of my webpage, I encourage you to go look at that. The webpage, jmccsci.com, short for jmccsci.com. The short URL, jmccs as in Sam, c as in Charlie, i as in indigo.com. The very top picture is the Eye of the Sahara. Now, something I've been studying recently, there's some regions in the Sahara Desert, south of Egypt and then moving in a southwesterly direction, that have had unquestionably electrical discharge activity in these areas. And I'll be talking more about these as I discuss some of them. Some of them are extremely remote areas. But the Eye of the Sahara has all the characteristics of an electrical discharge, just like the Tunguska site in Russia. And so I've talked about that before in my show, where the Tunguska site was an electrical discharge. I worked with the Russian scientists out of the University of Novosibirsk who had gone to Tunguska and studied it, and they realized that the Western press always tries to talk about it as an asteroid hitting. Well, they knew that, first of all, there's no asteroid, there's no hole in the ground. It's just a center area that shows all of the characteristics of a high energy electrical discharge, and the iron oxide, the formation, the in the region with the magnetic fields and rings, the trees blown down for 100 kilometers around. And so the Tunguska site is a characteristic site of an electrical discharge that had to have come from a passing comet. And all of the other characteristics there, when the Tunguska event occurred for days before and afterwards, people saw the night sky illuminated. And so there again, that's characteristic of a comet passing by. Now, the reason this is important is because some people are attempting to say that the Grand Canyon, for example, or the Valles Marineris on Mars were cut out by electrical discharges. And so this brings up some very interesting things that happened in New Zealand over the past week, and in Japan. There are sinkholes, basically, that especially the one in New Zealand. I have some photos up on my webpage, the picture of the day that go along with this radio show, of they're not exactly sinkholes, but they're just long trenches where the earth split apart during an earthquake. And now I have flown over the Grand Canyon. And when you look at it, it's very interesting. It's like it literally split apart. And when it comes up to the very end of the Grand Canyon, you're up on the flat plateau above. And there it is. It's a split. It's not characteristic of a burn mark. And all of that material would have turned into mountains of glass-type material all over the place. In fact, some of the locations in the Sahara Desert where there were electrical discharges are littered with glass. And that's one of the characteristics. So one of the characteristics is the electromagnetic signatures that are left in, that are the electromagnetic discharge leaves in the ground, the patterns, the melting of the ground. So it's not, the ground just doesn't disappear. It turns into another form during an electrical discharge, primarily glass, and then other forms of glass-related materials, and they're not related to volcanic glass. There's a very different formative process for volcanic glass than there is for electrical discharge glass. And that's a very important point. So around the Grand Canyon, you do not find the characteristic glass that would have been formed by an electrical discharge. And so let's go to New Zealand now. New Zealand this past week had ongoing earthquakes. I forget when it actually began. Of course, New Zealand has had earthquake activity. It's a volatile area. But this past week, a major earthquake, and the ground simply opened up in large trenches formed, and the ground is still sitting down there with the trees and the grass that used to be up on the upper levels. Now, the question is, did this happen because there were underground vacancies where this material just fell in? Well, that's part of the issue. Let's look at Florida. I have always said that if ever there was an earthquake in Florida, all of those pockets of sand that are loose down there underneath the ground, because Florida is one of the locations in the world prone to sinkholes in certain regions, other regions not. But the earthquake, if there were an earthquake that affected Florida, then it would there would be many regions that would just fall into holes in the ground. And this is what's happening in New Zealand. So that's one issue. The other one is, let's take a look at a place called Bryce Canyon in Utah. And it's amazing. This area is, you know, tens of square miles, if not hundreds of square miles, and it simply dropped in to the ground. And so apparently what happened is that when the earth is forming or there was volcanic activity, you can form what you call lava tubes. So they're large areas, and as these rock formations eventually break down, if there was an earthquake of sufficient magnitude, it'd be enough for these regions to drop in. But of course, we don't have a good solid history of the area. The geology explanation that is standard for Bryce Canyon is ridiculous, that the land came up and then it dropped down, and then it came up again, then dropped down. Like, it's so ridiculous. But the point is that the earth has void areas, cavern areas underneath, and the ground can simply fall in. And the Grand Canyon is another example. But on a worldwide scale, like the Grand Canyon, what can happen also is that as the earth shakes back and forth during an earthquake, the land can literally split open, and literally a split, and the ground can just fall into that crack. Whereas in other places, this is common around, say, the base of the Rocky Mountains or mountain ranges where you have the foothills. Those foothills are the compression of the earth, whereas in other areas, the earth actually splits apart. If something is compressed, then there's other parts of the earth that have to give and make up for that. So therefore, you have splits in the earth's crust or in the surface of the earth, or in the case of Mars, Valles Marineris, the same thing. Now, what's going to cause something like that? The planet is not going to jump up and do this by itself. So the passage of a large comet nucleus is the thing, that the element that causes these type of grandiose worldwide planet-wide effects. And we see this on moons also that don't even have plate tectonics. We see the land splitting open. There's examples of this on moons around the solar system. So anyway, I encourage you to take a look at the pictures of the day. When you go to pull this show down in the archive subpage, or if you just scroll down to the center part of my homepage, you will see the pictures of the day, and take a look at these pictures there. But they were sent in by a listener of actually on the site in New Zealand, showing how the land has just fallen in, you know, just these cracks have developed and the land has fallen in. Now, we hear about this also in the Bible and in ancient text, where the earth opens up and literally, you know, they have stories about people falling into these caverns and basically the earth opening up and falling in during earthquakes. At any rate, take a look at those pictures, very much worth looking at. This past week also, Japan had a major earthquake. They have sinkhole issues in Japan. Now, an entire area of in the center of a city, the street fell in. And once again, I remember when I was a kid, in fact, living in the Midwest, one time the end of a street just sank and fell in. And they discovered what had happened is it was either the sewer, the water line was leaking, and so it developed an underground, basically river, where it was washing the ground away underneath, and then eventually just the weight, of course, of the surface couldn't hold itself up anymore, so this vast area just sank right down into the ground. So that's another major cause of these events, where you have water coming down underneath the ground, opening up very large cavities, and then you end up with massive sinkholes. So an area like Bryce Canyon could have had a massive river system underground passing underneath, and then causing eventually the erosion of the area underneath the ground, and then it just sank in, going down hundreds and hundreds of feet. So Bryce Canyon, very interesting place to visit. But the you have to understand that there was some geological mechanism to create a vast void, and then eventually, whoosh, this entire region just sank down hundreds and hundreds of feet. You can still, and you can tell that that's what happened because the stratifications layers in the earth, you can match the ones that have fallen down by with the walls of the canyon that are up higher. You can match them layer for layer. So it's very easy to see that these have fallen down in. Very interesting. In Japan also, and I've posted this photo on my webpage, also in the picture of the day region, a young person took a video of a meteor coming into the atmosphere. Now, past spring, I talked about the rods from God that affected Ecuador, causing the earthquakes. And somebody sent an email and said, is this a rod from God? Because it happened a little bit afterwards of the big earthquake in Japan, which was, what, a 7.8 or something like that. And they wanted to know if this could have been possibly a rod from God. But the end result is no, this was not a rod from God. It was a characteristic natural meteor. And the way you tell is the rods from God have a very thin tail that extends all along the path, behind the path of the object, and stays there for a considerable amount of time. And that's one of the characteristics. There's other characteristics. I've explained this before in my radio show, but the one photographed by this person in Japan is a real meteor. It has a big bulbous head. It has the column of smoke and melted debris that's coming off of this object is very smooth. It comes back to a rather fine tail, and then it ends. There's no little thin tail coming out the back end. So this is a true meteor. So that's really wonderful to have a picture. There's some other videos that you can look of. There's a very famous video taken by an 8mm camera. It was in Colorado back in the 50s. And it's of a bolide coming across the upper atmosphere. And it skims the Earth's atmosphere and then leaves again. So I guess we're pretty lucky it didn't hit. But it skims across the Earth's atmosphere, and you can hear it rumbling as this object comes through the upper atmosphere. But there again, that characteristic bolide meteor shape of the, I guess you'd call it coma, the gaseous cloud that surrounds this, and very, very smooth, and coming back to a tip at the trailing edge, and no fine squiggly line coming out the back end that's characteristic of rods from God. So once again, go to the webpage and check that out. Really wonderful photos. And so know that that was not related to the earthquake. It came in after the earthquake, and it was not a rod from God. So there's certain events that I talk about because I know, I have firsthand information, like the Ecuador earthquakes that were created with a military weapon. But there are just tons and tons of naturally occurring earthquakes, volcanoes, atmospheric conditions, and many of them you can tell are natural. Some people were also asking if the elevated amount of number of earthquakes in the past week had anything to do with the great full moon that occurred. I think that was on the, was it the 14th of November? And the answer is no. I mean, there are all of these effects occurring, but first of all, these did not occur within a time frame. There was some guy that said he made a prediction that there would be a major earthquake in the world plus or minus 2 days of the full moon. Well, that's like saying it's going to snow this winter, you know, in Minnesota. You're probably going to be right. You know, you're going to probably be close. And so they said that he had predicted this major earthquake in New Zealand. But sorry, that is not a prediction. If you're predicting, here's the issue with earthquake prediction. First of all, you have to be predicting something that's in a specific region. He was not. He was just saying this could happen any place in the world. Well, anybody could say that. And 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, you would actually be correct, because there are major earthquakes going on in the world every day of the year. Very rarely would a day pass without a major earthquake somewhere on the planet. So if somebody says, oh, during this full moon, plus and minus 2 days, there's going to be a major earthquake, well, you could pick any day and make the same prediction and probably be pretty much correct. Anyway, no, the reality is relative to the moon, we are weightless. There are differential forces. They're called tidal forces. And that's due to the fact that the nearest side of the moon is closer to us than the far side of the moon. So there's a differential effect of gravity. But that happens every month. And so the fact that the moon is 5% closer certainly could possibly have a predictive effect. But there are thousands of processes at work in the Earth's crust. And so you cannot single out one process and say that's what's causing all these earthquakes. Because, first of all, we don't have information on all of the processes going on down in the Earth. They're still discovering fault lines that are in the San Andreas Fault near Los Angeles. They don't have all of these mapped yet. So how could you possibly make predictions if you don't even know where the fault lines are, let alone the conditions, the stress points, which ones are being stressed, which ones are not being stressed? We don't have this data. You can't make scientific predictions unless you have a lot more data and a lot of variation in that data, understanding all the various conditions. Then you could possibly begin to make predictions. And with weather, for example, we can measure atmospheric conditions, ocean conditions, upper atmospheric wind conditions, and you put all that together and you can make some kind of semblance of weather predictions, even though they're wrong about 50% of the time. But with earthquakes underground, where we have almost no data, reliable data, and certainly not the level of data that you would need to make any type of educated guess, simply not happening. So to take one factor like the full moon and say, oh, that's going to, I'm predicting earthquakes on such and such a day. Sorry, buddy. And especially when they say plus or minus 2 days, you know, doubly sorry, buddy. Just not, you know, it's bogus science. Certainly nothing worth noting or writing up in a newspaper article. Just a quick comment. NASA published an article recently, and I talked about this on a radio show a while ago, where we're talking about a peer-reviewed article, and it's called the EM Drive. And it looks like a typical rocket engine that maybe Goddard would have built back in the 1930s. It's just a shroud with a flat top. It's not even a cone-shaped rocket nozzle. And they say by bouncing microwave radiation back and forth in this channel that they are getting some form of propulsion. Well, in the peer-reviewed publication, NASA says they're not really sure that it works. They think it works, and they don't know why it works. So they start giving some gobbledygook about quantum mechanical effects or something. But I wouldn't start packing my bags yet to go to Mars. I grew up during the era, through the era of, say, the ion engine, something that's in current use, very successful. And I remember the very first was one of the International Electric Propulsion Conferences that I went to talk at. I was a speaker there, and on my own magnetic propulsion systems. But the ion engines were being introduced at that time, and they were simply basically a metal pipe on a table. And I looked at that, and I thought, well, that's interesting. But clearly the ion engines do work. They have a specific impulse, which is sufficient for them to be viable in outer space. But that'll be interesting because the EM engine does not require mass. It requires energy. So you could get energy from solar panels or possibly a nuclear reactor, something like that. But they don't know how it works yet. And so there's possibly some physics going on here. I haven't really taken a look at this myself. It's, you know, about 250 on my list of things to do. But it'd be interesting to look into this. But like I say, I wouldn't pack my bags quite yet for this. And one of my particular inventions deals with a passive propulsion system that was my talk that I gave back in, 2003? At the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, called Electric Highways to the Stars. And so, anyway, you can see that video. It's in my video collection, my historically important videos. I think it's video number one or two in the DVD collection, the DVD number one and two that are available on the webpage. But there are simple ways to travel, and it's safe to say, however, that inertial engines, that is, an engine which heats up some type of matter by some mechanism and shoots it out a nozzle, that type of a rocket is not a viable mechanism to go into space or to navigate in outer space. Clearly, you may need those for local purposes around planets, for landing, other things like that. But the mechanisms for actually traveling in outer space are much simpler, and they are non-inertial. In other words, you don't heat up mass and throw it out the back of a rocket engine. There are better ways to go into space. This is a rather important news event. Typically, I stay away from mainstream news events. But Russia this past week pulled out of the World Court. Now, this is significant in that it would be nice to have a world court system where you could go and effectively prosecute international crimes, primarily war crimes, etc. But in 2002, the United States pulled out because they were accused of attacking Iraq and Afghanistan, and so they pulled out their support, effectively saying, you can't take us to this international court, settlement court for. And like I say, it's typically over wars, and the result damage of war activity or policing or whatever you might call it, or human rights violations, etc. So it only works if the countries stay in it. Now, the reason that the Russians pulled out was because the World Court was trying to accuse them of basically war crimes in the Ukraine. And Russia's point of view is that the Ukraine was part of their country, so it would be like someone coming in and creating trouble in New York, some foreign entity, and then trying to create a situation where New York would fall away from being one of the 50 states. And this is not due to internal policy or votes of the people. This is due to a foreign government intervention. And so for that reason, Putin pulled out, because his consideration is that the CIA was very much involved in the downfall of the Ukraine, which is exactly true. That's exactly what did happen. But the fact, you know, be that as it may, and some people have made different opinions, whatever, it doesn't matter. The fact is that the World Court has failed. And there is no entity at this point, like after World War II, there were the Nuremberg trials. The world has been looking for a court system, and it has failed once again to come up with that actually necessary item. The United Nations was supposed to be an organization, a neutral organization to prevent war, to prosper peace, and to prevent conflict. But they have been completely taken over by the same people who are creating the wars. And so it wouldn't be surprising to me if eventually the United States told the United Nations, simply leave, get out of New York, go find another place to hang out, and don't come back here. Don't involve yourself. But the United States is very much being handed over in October. I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but in October, Obama handed over the control of the internet to the United Nations from the United States. And there's many other executive orders, all of which I suspect will be canceled in short order very soon. But the unfortunate situation is that, once again, the world has not been able to get it together to have a single court system. And the politics range up into the international banking empire. And the end result is the world does not have a court system, a viable court system for international claims, especially against human crimes against humanity and civilian populations. There are some new developments on my webpage, and I just want to quickly go over these. I don't want to spend a lot of time, but I'm starting to promote more and more the water tanks. And this is something I really feel strongly about. That's why I became an international distributor for water tanks for Canada and the 48 states. But more and more people are waking up to the fact, and here's the situation. A water tank, let's say you have four people in your family, you need 5 gallons per person per day. That's 20 gallons per day. In a week, that would amount to, and so simple calculation, 140 gallons a week, or around 550 gallons a month. And so that's conservative. Now, that 5 gallons per person per day is really not much. That's what's considered by the World Health Organization to be absolute minimum. You know, if you're talking about showers and hygiene and all of the other necessities of water. So double that, we're talking 1,000 gallons in a month for a family of four. If you have other issues going on and you need water, then, you know, it could be more than that. So, and I have myself lived in situations where I've had a water tank, and it's amazing how fast, with the kitchen sink running, etc., it's amazing how fast you can go through 3,000 gallons. So what I've done is I'm giving a special on the water tanks. if you buy a water tank and a 10-pack of the filter elements. Now, the other thing about a water tank is you don't just want to fill it with rainwater or water coming out of a stream. You want to filter the water before it goes into the tank. So that's where the under sink filter comes in. That's on the sales page. So I'm giving that filter away free if you also buy with the water tank a 10-pack of the filter elements. And so anyway, and people are doing this. So that's on a sale on my webpage. I just want to mention the other things that are going on just until Sunday. If you buy a 10-pack of filter elements, you get 11. There's already a 10% sale, and some of these I have an increased sale with the red letter sale. If you buy any full-size water filter, which is already 10% discounted, we'll throw in an extra additional filter for free. And remember, I give you 4 filters, elements with my filters, where the other outfits give you 2 filter elements of the old outdated. My filter elements are the all-in-one GF filters and no add-ons required. Or the last issue is if you are looking for something for emergency water filtration, the Chemrad oil pre-filter, if you buy the pre-filter and the accessory set, we'll throw in a Recalendar SunStar clock for free. Anyway, that information is on my webpage. Go there, take a look at that. The tanks, people are buying these, and we can deliver them to any place in Canada or the 48 states, not available in Alaska or Hawaii. So I encourage you to take a look at that. Become independent, and there are tanks that are small. The tote tank, which is a cube tank, will hold the same equivalent of 6 barrels, 55-gallon barrels of water. And that's only $350, so plus, of course, shipping. And all the water filters, free shipping. Okay, enough of that. I'm sorry I kind of threw this in. It sounded like a commercial, but really, I'm trying to help people become independent. And this is number one. Water is number one. If there's something going on, some problem or an emergency or bad weather or whatever, you don't want to be standing there filling your bathtub with water and then maybe the water has already gone out. You have to be prepared. Water is number one. I'm recommending that everybody get my tanks go from 225 gallons up to 20,000 gallons. So what I'm recommending is that people become water independent. Also, storage. So you need a filter to filter the water to put into the tank. All that's on the webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, well, on to the next science topic. I'm going to go back to the Eye of the Sahara. I'm going to talk about Tunguska, the event of 1905 that is clearly an atmospheric electrical discharge site that came literally from a passing comet. And talk about these two events because the other main topic I want to deal with here is called magnetite, which is an oxide form of iron. It's one of the main forms in which you find iron naturally in the earth. But there's a type of magnetite which the ancients discovered and was one of the early recognized form of magnetism, and that's why magnetism actually became known, because the lodestones actually contain a small magnetic field, and they can actually be increased. You buy these a lot of times in rock stores when you're traveling. You know, you go out west or Montana or the Dakotas, and every time you stop in a little curio shop to buy tourist items, they'll have a box full of these magnetite stones. In fact, I once built a small motor based on these, showing that the primitive people could have possibly built electromagnetic generators using a naturally occurring ferrous oxide materials like this. But the reason this is important in, for example, the Eye of the Sahara and the Tunguska site is because, first of all, there's no location where an asteroid hit, so these are obviously not related to an asteroid strike or the strike of even a small bolide. And these are immense. You can see both of these events from outer space. You can see the effects of hundreds of kilometers. The eye of the Sahara is an immense mark on the surface of the Earth, circular. Like I say, go to the very top of my homepage and you'll see a picture. And on the very far right side of the homepage, there's a little box to find. You can click on that and get a very nice full screen view of the eye of the Sahara. But what is important is that around in the rings that surround these symmetrical circular rings that surround the discharge impact spot are large volumes of lodestones or ferrous oxide magnetized. Now, how does this happen? And this is what I want to explain. When an electrical discharge hits the Earth, there's a tremendous amount of energy. That energy is passing through the ground. And we also see this, by the way, one of the first electrical interplanetary discharge sites to be recognized in outer space. If not the first, I believe it was the first, I located on the moon Callisto of Jupiter. And I show that in my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. It's also in my three-part comet paper, which is in the appendix of that book, which was published in the early 1980s when the data first came back from the Voyager spacecraft passing Jupiter. But here's an example. If you take an electrical current through a wire, take a wire, pass it through a piece of paper on a table, and put a piece of paper there with a little hole in it and sprinkle iron filings around on the table. If you pass an electrical current through that wire, the magnetic field will align the iron filings in little circles. And so that's what we're seeing here. That's part of the process. But the other part of the process is the fact that iron is in the ground. It melts, and then it solidifies very quickly, and there's still enough electrical current in that discharge where the iron oxide is picking up the magnetic field, and then it cools through the Curie temperature. The Curie temperature is the temperature at which the magnetic field is locked into a solid, and then it remains magnetized for all future time, unless, of course, it's melted again. But the other thing I was saying is in these discharge sites, in these locations, you see forms of glass which are different from volcanic glass. So these are not volcanic formations. These are locations on Earth, very definitively, no question about it, sites where electrical discharges from outer space have occurred. The interesting thing about the Sahara is that there are in a line locations where electrical discharges occurred. There are some areas where there's a large amount of glass, not volcanic glass, laying all over the surface. So this is indicative, once again, of an electrical discharge hitting and basically turning the silicates into glass, and a very high temperature formation glass. The interesting thing is that these are all in a line, which tells me that this could have been the Venus event when we talk about Moses looking up and seeing, remember the pillar of fire that stretched into the sky? That's what it would have looked like, because it would be like a tornado, and that's what a tornado literally is, or a dust devil. There are electrical currents that attach from around the ground up into an vertical electric current in the vertical electric field of Earth. And as the ionized air is drawn upwards in the electrical current, it spins like this is the Coriolis force at work. This is the same effect that happens when you pull the plug in the bathtub and the water drains down and it starts to form that little cyclonic eddy current that goes down the drain. The only difference is this is going up the drain. And so the end effect is that that's what it would look like, a huge pillar of fire extending up into the sky. And I still find it remarkable that in the 1950s, the Charlton Heston Hollywood movie, The Ten Commandments, if you've never seen that, go get it or just look at it online. They have a wonderful depiction of the pillar of fire. And this is, once again, all of the plagues revolving around the Moses event, when the Israelites came out of Israel, or when they came out of Egypt. This was with Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt. This was an event in which they describe all of the seven plagues, which all can be explained, and I have this on my CD, my two CD set, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. I talk about the Moses event and how all of the plagues are easily explained and correctly explained by a passing comet, not the least of which is the pillar of fire, and not the least of which also is the burning bush, the bush that burned without being consumed, and the fact that a pillar of light in the sky lit the Israelites' passage for 40 years, and that would have been a period of time when Venus would have been in the sky as a large comet, a really large comet, dwarfing, for example, Hale-Bopp, which would have been an immense comet if we would have been near it. So at any rate, what we're talking about is potentially the location we can track, possibly the path of Venus coming across the sky and across that path through the over the Sahara Desert. We know it was in southern Egypt, around right off the Red Sea, you know, just down the coastline on the west side of the Red Sea before they crossed. And of course, the parting of the Red Sea additionally was due to the comet tidal activity, the gravitational activity of the passing comet. And, you know, there again, moving the waters for the safe passage and timing it so that if you, in many events like this, people call it an act of God, and very well it could have been. But related to natural events, the comet passing by. But right now I'm looking into these events in the northern Sahara Desert of Africa, and very interesting. There's a lot of information available. Very, very difficult places to get to, but in the ring of the Eye of the Sahara, you find the magnetite. And the magnetite is magnetized because, let's take another example. Say you took iron, the ferrous oxide, the Fe3O4, which is the chemical combination for magnetite, or lodestone is another term. Remember that lodestone is magnetite that carries a magnetic field, a permanent magnetic field. If you heated these materials, ferrous oxide, the Fe3O4, if you heated this up to a molten state and then just let it cool with no inherent or external magnetic field around, it would not maintain a magnetic field, possibly extremely small one, due to random movement of the little the molecules. But if you put this in a magnetic field and then cool it down, that's where the magnetite becomes magnetized. And if you buy these, I bought little bags of these magnetite pieces. They put them through a grinder in a sand, like a drum, which smooths. Provides a smooth surface for the magnetite little rocks. But they have a very strong magnetic field, very naturally. So also around the American Southwest, starting in the Dakotas and going down into the Southwest, you find large volumes of lodestone that are highly magnetized. These are naturally occurring. So the United States is an area where there had to have been large amounts of electrical discharges from passing cometary type of events. Earth did not do this by itself. And so the point is that I'm working on a study of these locations because they are related. They're related in space and time. So they probably occurred at the same time. It's very difficult to say because there could have been multiple passages of comets that caused these various events individually. So you have to be very careful about claims. But I wanted to make it clear also that let's go back to the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon is literally a split in the surface of the Earth. And if that volume of material had been cut out with an electrical discharge, you would have glass all over the countryside there for probably 100 miles around. You would have this high heat formation forms of glass, and you do not find it. You do not find it at all. So that tells you that the Grand Canyon is a result of a split. Now, there's something on Mars. When this first came out and was discovered by the Mars rovers, some of the early ones, NASA called them blueberries, and they were a blue form of rock or glass rock that were found strewn all over Mars. There again, you can say safely that Mars had electrical discharge activity, and we know this also. The ancients talk about it, the fact that Mars was a blue planet. It lost its atmosphere and oceans within the past 10,000 years, and that's why we see the dry hulk of the planet we see on Mars today. But Mars also, in having the round droplets, basically, of glass, indicative of very high temperature electrical discharge activity from a large passing comet. So at any rate, I hope this rounds out this topic. A listener wrote in, and this is something we're working on in the background, is to get the subjects for all of my shows going back through the years, 15 years plus of radio shows. And we're working on that so that eventually you can go in and you can cross-reference, find titles that you're interested in, and go back and listen to certain shows. But that's another big project that's possibly in the future. Just want to remind you that the webpage, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. The sale on the tanks, wonderful sale with that free undersink water filter. You can hook it in line and have that go directly into the tank so that you can keep your tank, water tank, your security water tank, or for your animals, or for the farm or ranch or cabin. Keep that tank full of freshly filtered water, and the tanks go from 225 gallons up to 20,000, so something for everybody. Plus, remember, if you buy a 10-pack of water filter elements, you get 11. If you buy any water filter, full-size water filter, you get an extra filter element. And if you buy the pre-filter plus an accessory set, you get the free Recalendar Sun Start Clock. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.